Hello, my name is Allie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Sidley Austin Sunshine Act teleconference. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host for the day, Mr. Jim Stansel. Sir, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Allie, very much, and welcome, everybody. We're glad that you've joined us for this Q&A session. My name's Jim Stansel. I'll be the moderator today. I'm the co-head of the Global Life Sciences team here at Sidley Austin, and my practice focuses on counseling and litigation of reimbursement, price reporting, disclosure, and other healthcare issues, principally for pharmaceutical, biotech, and medical device manufacturers. Before rejoining Sidley, I previously served at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as Deputy General Counsel with responsibility for all of the CMS legal issues, and then as Acting General Counsel of the department. Just a couple of administrative notes for today's call. You should have received a slide deck in preparation for this call. If you have not, please email sfevents, that's like San Francisco events, @sidley.com, or you can phone Brian Ferguson at 415-772-1245, and he'll send you the slide deck. Just want to let you know that Sidley Austin is a State Bar of California-approved CLE provider and an accredited provider of New York and Illinois MCLE credit. This program is approved for one general credit in the California and Illinois programs, and we'll send out a feedback form to all participants at the end of the program for that credit. We have a couple more things. During the faculty presentations, your phone will be on mute during our affirmative presentation. When we get ready at the end to take questions, the operator will come back on and announce how you can get in line to ask your remaining questions. And we do appreciate that so many of you have sent in questions. In fact, so many of you have sent in questions that we're going to be unable to answer all of them in the affirmative section because of the limited time that we have available for the call. So we're going to focus on the questions that we received that seem to be of common interest. However, we'll have probably about 10 minutes at the end that you can raise additional questions if you'd like. Feel free to do that at the end. If you still don't get your question answered or you have further questions, obviously, please feel free to call any of us, and we'd be happy to help you with those. The discussion that we'll have about the questions is necessarily going to be some general observations, and any specific answers could vary based on the particular facts and circumstances. So our answers today are not intended to be legal advice. It's also important to note at the outset here that we're talking about a proposed rule, and that we, of course, don't know what will be in the final rule, so the answers can, and in some cases are likely, to change if the final rule varies from the proposed. Now, if you'll turn to your slide deck, we're going to give a little bit of background of the proposed rule and the Act, and then we'll turn to the questions that we've received, and then at the end, as I said, we'll open it up for any additional questions. I'm going to start on slide three, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues. Just as general background on the purpose of the Act, certainly the government and some particular senators and certainly the OIG have been concerned about potential conflicts of interest and inappropriate influence that can be exerted by physicians in the pharmaceutical, biotech, and device space. So the disclosure that's required by the Act is intended to do a few things. We've listed a couple of them here. I want to point out one that we actually haven't listed, and that's the question of whether the disclosure actually under the Sunshine Act is really intended to get manufacturers to stop maybe some relationships that they currently have because they don't want those disclosed. But certainly the stated intention is that it would make those disclosures transparent, that it will increase the public's awareness and allow them to have access to that information, and then, of course, discouraging any conflicts of interest. The proposed rule does seek comments, And now's the time to have your voice heard about any concerns that you have or how you'd like to influence the rule. If you'll turn to slide four, just gives a little bit of a summary there of the proposed rule issued in the middle of December. And it potentially impacts a lot of aspects of the Sunshine Act, and we've listed out some of them here, including many of the important definitions and what actually has to be reported. Now, I will say that it leaves a lot unanswered, and that's certainly one thing that can be done through the comment process, and CMS is accepting those comments through February 17th. I'm now going to turn it over to my colleagues, and I'd like to introduce them. First, we'll hear from Haewon Min Liao. Haewon is a partner in our San Francisco office after having spent several years in the Washington, D.C. office. Haewon works with manufacturers as well as financial institutions, DME suppliers, hospitals, and other providers in advising them on healthcare compliance regulatory issues, including the Sunshine Act. She spends a portion of her practice advising on due diligence related to healthcare transactions, and she provides healthcare expertise on litigation matters. We'll then hear from Danielle McCutcheon, who is an associate in our Chicago office. Her practice focuses primarily on healthcare regulatory compliance and fraud and abuse matters. She's advised a wide variety of clients on Sunshine Act issues and also regularly advises clients on state compliance laws. Finally, Manaksha Datta is a partner in our Chicago office. She has substantial experience in various areas of healthcare regulatory law, including healthcare reform, fraud and abuse, and compliance issues. She's assisted clients on a wide variety of sunshine and state law compliance matters, including drafting policies and procedures, counseling on legal and implementation issues, and conducting audits and internal reviews. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Haewon first for some of our short introduction to the law. Haewon.
Thanks so much, Jim. Now, surprisingly, and I'm sure many of you were surprised, CMS has stated that it's not going to require applicable manufacturers to compile the data until after it issues the final rule. I had actually expected an interim final rule, so I was pleased to see a proposed rule. CMS is going to build in a cushion, albeit a very small cushion, of 90 days after the final rule is issued to allow manufacturers to prepare for compliance. Now, CMS is going to be accepting a lot of comments on specific hurdles companies are facing to operationalize aspects of this rule, and we'll get into that more in the Q&A section. CMS is also considering now whether to require the data to be collected for part of 2012 after the final rule is issued, and whether that should be reported to CMS by March 31st, 2013. Now, I'm going to turn it over to Danielle, who's going to address some more important definitions.
Thanks, Haewon. So the proposed rule seeks to expand the definition of applicable manufacturer. Under the proposed rule, any manufacturer that sells or distributes a covered product in the United States, regardless of where that manufacturer is physically located or incorporated, would be considered an applicable manufacturer under the rule. The proposed rule also seeks to define applicable manufacturer as any manufacturer that sells at least one covered product. And under the statute, a covered product is any drug, device, medical supply, or biologic where payment is available under the federal health care programs. So this requirement would require manufacturers that have only one or two products to report all payments and transfers of value to any doctors and teaching hospitals as long as they have that one product. And then we also just wanted to point out for you that covered recipients themselves have no reporting obligations under the Act. So doctors and teaching hospitals don't have to report. Moving on to slide seven. In connection with the definition of applicable manufacturer, CMS is considering two definitions for the term common ownership. Under the statute, any entity that assists or supports a manufacturer with certain things is considered part of the applicable manufacturer, and any payments they make are reportable by the manufacturer. So under these definitions, one's slightly broader than the other. The broader proposal defines common ownership as when the same individual or entity directly or indirectly owns any portion of two or more entities. And then there's a narrower definition for common ownership where any two individuals or entities have 5% or more interest in the same entities. So depending on the relationships among these entities, manufacturers may be required to report separate reports to CMS for each of their business units, or they may be able to report a combined report if they're under common ownership. This is a consideration for manufacturers, particularly those who have operations overseas or who have multiple layers of their business. And then for slide 8, under the statute, the Act defines covered recipients to include any physician or teaching hospital, and the proposed rule adapts those definitions. And so for physicians, CMS proposes to use the statutory definition, which is defined as any U.S. licensed physician. Also includes doctors of osteopathy, dentists, podiatrists, et cetera. The definition does not include physicians who are employees of the manufacturer. And under the statute and the proposed rule, employees defined as it is under common law for those relationships between employees and employers. For teaching hospitals, CMS proposes to define these as institutions that receive Medicare graduate medical education payments. And CMS acknowledges that it would be difficult for manufacturers to identify those institutions that receive such grants. And so it proposes to annually publish an exhaustive list of those entities on the agency's website. So now turning it back over to Haywan.
Thanks. We'll be on slide 9. There are a number of significant exceptions to the tracking reporting requirements. And of course, one of them is this directly benefiting patient exception. So if an educational item directly benefits patients or is intended for patient use, then it doesn't have to be reported. But now if you compare this to what has been historically interpreted to be permitted under the Pharma or AdvaMed codes, this is actually narrower. CMS is seeking your comments on whether these items given to recipients to educate themselves, such as textbooks, for example, should be included in this exception. In the preamble discussion, what's interesting to me is that CMS is distinguishing materials from, quote, services or items. It's not really clear. They don't give specific examples. And you could even say, aren't items also material? Now, CMS is talking about food and beverage requirements. These requirements are, again, ripe for comments. CMS seems to be attempting to create practical guidelines, but it's also complicated by the overlay of the $10 rule. So the general rule is that if a manufacturer, an applicable manufacturer, provides a meal in a group setting, then you report the cost per covered recipient. What this means is that for a lunch given to a doctor's office, covered recipient doctor's office, you divide that amount by the covered recipient, whether or not that doc was at the lunch or not. So let's say if the lunch is worth $50 and there are two doctors associated with that practice, you would report $25 per doc. Now, if the lunch is also, again, worth $50, but there are 10 doctors associated with that practice who are covered recipients, it would be $5 per doctor. But applying the $10 rule, a payment less than $10 does not need to be reported unless the aggregate for the year is over $100. So basically, you're still really tracking it. CMS wants to know if a different approach should apply to really large physician practices or hospitals. And CMS is proposing that manufacturers don't have to report buffet meals, snacks, or coffee at booths for conferences or similar events. We're not sure what similar events means here. Again, the rationale is that it may be just too hard for the applicable manufacturer to establish the identities of the doctors, and so there is this little loophole. Okay, we're going to turn to some fundamental questions about what it means to report research. I'm on slide 11 for those of you following the presentation slides. I've got three questions for you. One, what counts as research? Two, how do you report research? And there's a distinction between direct versus indirect payments. And three, what's the deal with delayed publication? So let's tackle these one by one. One, there is no set definition of research itself. The regs tell us to use a dictionary definition. What makes it a little bit confusing is that there is a distinct definition for clinical investigations. The statute distinguishes among what research is versus development versus clinical investigations. But CMS itself is acknowledging that it's really hard to separate out meaningfully what research and development is, because so many of the activities are overlapping, and they're seeking your input on that and making that distinction, or whether to make that distinction. The proposed definition of clinical investigation is any experiment involving one or more human subjects in which a drug or device is administered, dispensed, or used. So the key there is, does it involve a human being? And in the preamble language, CMS refers to clinical investigations as being a subset of research. Now, one thing to keep in mind is that research or development contracts have to include a written agreement and research protocol between the manufacturer and the cover recipient. And ultimately, the key for CMS is this a bona fide research activity? So let's move on to our second question. How do you report research? What is a direct research payment? That occurs when a physician or a teaching hospital cover recipient gets payment directly from an applicable manufacturer or a CRO entity. Now, this is distinguished from what is an indirect research payment. And that occurs when the money or transfer of value goes from either an applicable manufacturer or CRO to a clinic or hospital or institution conducting the research, and these entities are not teaching hospitals under the regs, that then in turn give the money or transfer of value to a physician who is a principal investigator. So applicable manufacturers here have to keep in mind that they need to report things either as direct or indirect research payments. Question three, what's the deal with the delayed publication? Now, for certain payments, the publication of those payments or transfers of value will not be made public until after the earlier of two events. One, the date of the FDA approval or clearance, or 4 calendar years after the payment or transfer of value. And these payments or transfers of value include, one, research on or development of a new drug, device, or biological or medical supply, or a new application of an existing drug, device, biological, or medical supply. And it also includes clinical investigations regarding a new drug, device, biological, or medical supply. That was a mouthful. I will be now turning it back to Danielle.
Okay, thank you. So with speaking arrangements, this is another area where CMS is seeking comments. Under the statute, manufacturers are required to report direct compensation to physicians who serve as either faculty or speakers for a medical education program. CMS is seeking comments on whether it should broaden this payment category to include other types of situations where a physician provides speaker services, such as manufacturer-sponsored dinner programs. Moving on to 13. Here we're dealing with indirect payments. Under the statute, manufacturers are not required to report payments made to a third party that are then given to a covered recipient where the applicable manufacturer does not know ultimately who the covered recipient is. CMS proposes to interpret the awareness standard here as when an applicable manufacturer has actual knowledge of or acts in deliberate ignorance or reckless disregard of the identity of the recipient. So it's much higher standard than that you'd have to overcome there to be exempt from the payment obligation. And CMS states that this comports with the other fraud and abuse healthcare law standards for knowledge. For slide 14, consistent with the statute, CMS is going to permit applicable manufacturers to review their data after they've submitted it to CMS for 45 days. Parties will not be, again, able to review their data until the next review period the following year. And even then, you can only review and correct the current year and the prior year. CMS encourages applicable manufacturers to provide covered recipients with a pre-submission notice of the data they intend to submit, although this is not a requirement under the proposed rule or the Act. When there's a dispute between a manufacturer and a covered recipient or a physician investor, CMS proposes to require one of the parties to contact CMS and let them know about the dispute. And then if they cannot resolve the dispute within the 45-day review period, CMS proposes to note that the payment is disputed to publicize both payments from the covered recipient and the manufacturer or investor, and then to but to aggregate the covered recipient's data. So they're going to take the covered recipient's payment amount over the manufacturer's payment amount. One of our participants asked a question about checks and balances, and this is one example where CMS has implemented a process to allow manufacturers to kind of vet the data before it goes public. So now I'll hand it over to Mina for slide 15.
Great. Thanks, Danielle. Slide 15 has one of more CMS's significant proposals discussed. This has to deal with attestation. Now, the statute itself does not address in what manner the transparency reports must be submitted to CMS and whether any certification to the truth and accuracy of the data must be involved. However, CMS proposes to require each applicable manufacturer to require an authorized company representative, which they propose to define as the chief executive officer, the chief financial officer, or the chief compliance officer, to submit a signed attestation certifying the truth, correctness, and completeness of the data submitted. And this would need to be done on an annual basis when the transparency reports are submitted. In terms of the attestation, CMS proposes to apply a best of the signer's knowledge and belief as to the truthfulness, correctness, and completeness of the report. And there's also a separate but related proposal that would require manufacturers to register with CMS, applicable manufacturers to register with CMS. And under this proposal, even if a registered manufacturer does not have any reportable payments within a given year, the authorized representative would need to attest to that fact. Moving on quickly to slide 16, we've listed here the potential penalties for violations that are in the statute and reiterated in the proposal. I'm not going to repeat them here in the interest of getting to the questions from the audience, but one thing we do want to note, and this is important for compliance purposes, is that the Department of Health and Human Services, CMS, and OIG, Office of Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services, may audit applicable manufacturers for their compliance with the Act and the implementing regulations. And what will be interesting about this, and this is the second main bullet point on slide 16, is that, as is the case with any government audit or review, it is possible that the government could use such auditing opportunities to explore or investigate issues that are related or, frankly, unrelated to Sunshine Act compliance. And the transparency reports will provide a data mining opportunity for the agency and prosecutors and other interested parties to understand trends within the industry. And this can obviously provide opportunities to identify companies whose practices may be perceived as outliers within the industry. And the greater the level of granularity in the payment categories, arguably the greater the opportunity for these potential trends to be identified and analyzed. This could, for instance, and the proposed rule alludes to this, could create issues for device and drug manufacturers under the federal anti-kickback statute, the Federal False Claims Act, or the Stark Law. This could also create complexities for drug manufacturers under the price reporting laws if, for instance, there was a payment or a transfer of value that was not figured into the price reporting calculations, but which the government perceives or misperceives as a discount that should be taken into account for the calculations. Pass it back to Jim.
Great. Thanks, Mina.
Sure.
So we'll jump into the questions now. We've already actually answered a few of the questions that have been asked. We've grouped the questions, and our first section here is on the definition of applicable manufacturer. Mina, if you want to take these two questions on slide 17, does the Act apply to startup and or biotech companies that do not yet have an approved product in the United States? And then related to that, because Medicare and Medicaid sometimes pay for portions of clinical trials, if there is such reimbursement, then does that change the answer?
Sure. These are great questions. On the first issue, I wish there was an easy answer. I do think that there are some complexities that need to be considered. Certainly during the period a company has no product approved in the U.S. And the products are not the subject of a clinical trial, it cannot be said to be selling or distributing the product in the U.S. However, I could easily envision a scenario where a product is approved and marketed in the U.S. in, let's say, the third or fourth quarter of the calendar year. So in that situation, the question that needs to be considered and which is not addressed in the proposed rule is whether payments to covered recipients that may have occurred prior to the approval of the product and the availability of the product in the U.S., but in the same calendar year as when the product becomes available, whether those payments are reportable. And again, I don't think the proposed rule talks about this. So there could be arguments made in favor of either interpretation, and this is one area where companies could consider commenting. Briefly on the second question about whether products that are reimbursable in connection with a reimbursable clinical trial but have not otherwise been approved or sold or distributed in the U.S., there my thought was that the relevant definition to consider is that of covered drug, device, biological, or medical supply. Under the statute, the definition of that term turns on whether payment for the product is available under Medicare, Medicaid, or CHIP. Under the proposed rule, CMS interprets the term even further to mean where the payment is separately available on the product, such as on a fee schedule, or where a composite payment rate, such as under the inpatient prospective payment system or outpatient prospective payment system, is available. So under the proposed rule, I think that the answer would depend at least in part on whether that reimbursement for the clinical trial expenses, including the product, whether it would be considered separately reimbursable or potentially under some kind of composite rate reimbursement for the clinical trial expenses themselves. And just the other note is even if these payments are reportable, the delayed publication rules might apply, and so that's important to keep in mind as well.
Thanks, Mina. Next question is on slide 18. Are applicable manufacturers required to report payments or transfers of value made by the manufacturer's foreign affiliates to U.S. physicians?
Jim, this is Haywan. I could take this one.
Please.
If the manufacturer's foreign affiliate is deemed to be under common ownership with the U.S. manufacturer, or if the foreign affiliate sells or distributes covered products in the U.S., then yes, it is likely that any payment made by the foreign affiliate to a U.S. physician, licensed physician, would be reportable.
Okay.
Just one thing. As Danielle had mentioned, you know, it really doesn't matter where the entity is located. It's about whether the product is sold or distributed in the U.S.
Great. Thank you. Next question is slide 19. If a manufacturer is headquartered in the U.S. but does not sell or distribute any products in the U.S., is the manufacturer an applicable manufacturer for purposes of the Act, and are they required to report?
I can take this one, Jim. I think, again, you know, here the probably the simple answer is that if it really doesn't have any products that are sold or distributed in the U.S., you know, certainly that is one of the hooks, is whether you have a covered product. So if there is no sales or distribution activities in the U.S., then there would be no reporting activities.
Thanks. Danielle, let's go to you on slide 20 regarding the definition of covered recipient. Are applicable manufacturers required to report payments or transfers of value made to U.S. physicians while the physician is outside of the U.S.?
Sure. This is a question we've received quite often, actually. And the short answer to this, I think, is likely yes. The statute applies to all U.S. licensed physicians, and that's regardless of where they're located or domiciled. Therefore, payments made to a U.S. licensed physician who is outside of the U.S. would likely be reportable unless an exception applies. This would occur in circumstances such as if a physician went to a conference abroad, and while they're at the conference, a manufacturer either provided a meal or physician provided consulting services to the manufacturer, or for a physician who's living abroad for an extended period of time. We think this also comports with guidance in the AbaMed code, which states that the limitations in the code apply equally to manufacturers with doctors outside of the United States. It's possible then in the final rule, CMS might speak more directly to this question, but if it doesn't, this kind of still complicates tracking for manufacturers because it's not always the case that they'll know if a doctor is U.S. licensed. And to mitigate this, one thought would be for the manufacturer to implement certain processes to kind of on the front end get information from the doctor. So before engaging a doctor for a services agreement, or before entering into a royalty agreement, the manufacturer could compile a checklist or a questionnaire where they ask the doctor where they're licensed and other questions that might be relevant for the reporting, such as their MPI number, et cetera.
Thanks, Danielle. Mm-hmm. Slide 21 switches to employees of covered recipients. There, the question is, are applicable manufacturers required to report payments or transfers of value such as meals? And meals may be a key here, since this is probably one of the areas where it's most likely to occur, that are provided to non-covered recipient staff members of a physician office or hospital.
Sure. So here, I think at the outset, it's important to note that the Sunshine Act does not apply directly to hospital or physician office staff, but it does apply directly to covered recipients. So therefore, in the absence of a final rule and further guidance from CMS, the question really becomes a practical one. It's whether the manufacturer wants to spend the time and energy now on the front end to collect the data and track these payments, or whether they want to wait until more guidance is issued and make a determination then whether or not to report, and if they're going to report, to go back then and collect those payments. If the latter approach is taken, there's a risk to some extent that you might potentially underreport and then ultimately, or under-track, sorry, and then ultimately under-report. We should note that in the proposed rule, this has already been explained, there is a provision directly addressing food and beverages. And there, CMS proposes that when a manufacturer provides food or beverage to covered entities, staff, or others, those transfers of value will be imputed to the manufacturer, to the covered recipient. And so it's possible that in the final rule, CMS might take that same approach with other types of payments or transfers of value.
Thanks. And I think Danielle raises an important point here about the practicality. Some of the questions that are still fuzzy and maybe even still be fuzzy after the proposed rule comes out, but could be clarified later with guidance. I think manufacturers are going to have to decide if they want to take the time to track some of these things up front, or if things change, have to track them on the back end and go back and find them. And that's certainly there's a cost-benefit analysis there that will have to be undertaken. Slide 22 raises the issue of educational items. Are applicable manufacturers required to report educational items such as posters and anatomical models that are not provided to a covered recipient and not passed on to a patient?
I can take this one, Jim. This is a great question that we got from the audience. Under the Act, the exception for reporting for educational materials is limited to those materials that directly benefit patients or are intended for patient use. And as Haywan had described earlier, CMS proposes to broaden that exception to reach materials, educational materials, that are given to covered recipients where those materials arguably directly benefit patients or are intended for patient use. The only example they give is the example of a textbook. And, you know, the reason this question is coming up about posters and anatomical models, obviously, is because these are examples of educational items that are permitted under the Pharma Code and the AdvaMed Code and so on. And so, manufacturers could forego tracking of these items at this time and hope that through the comment period process that CMS will recognize educational items permitted under the Pharma and AdvaMed codes. But the risk here is that, at least under the proposed rule, CMS has given a pretty limited definition of what educational materials are and has only provided that one example of textbooks. So, and then they've also said, no other services or other items will fall within the exception. So there is room for CMS to interpret that exception a little bit more narrowly. And this is one of the areas where I think that the agency will benefit, the more stakeholders comment on this issue and encourage them to look through the lens of the Pharma and AdvaMed codes, which are really industry standard at this point.
Thanks. Going to slide 23. If an applicable manufacturer donates equipment to a nonprofit hospital, is the donation reportable? And then related to that, are contributions of products to charitable nonprofit organizations reportable when the recipient organization acts as an intermediary between the donating manufacturer and the covered recipients? Hey, Juan, do you want to take that one?
Sure. These are really good questions. Let's tackle the first one. The answer is that it depends. I have a couple of initial questions. Is the nonprofit hospital included in the list of hospitals covered, in the list of hospital covered recipients that CMS plans to publish? In other words, is the nonprofit hospital a covered recipient? If so, then the question is whether the donation fits into the definition of charity care. There's an exception from the reporting requirements for in-kind items used for the provision of charity care under the proposed rule. And the exception would apply only if the equipment would be used for patients who cannot pay for services. If the item is used for patient populations that both can pay and cannot pay, then the payment would not be excluded. So if you have a hospital that receives the item and uses it for both populations, and then assuming that the nonprofit hospital is an organization with tax-exempt status under the IRS code of 1986, which is the code that the rule, the preamble rule references, then you would report this as a charitable contribution in that situation. Turning to the second question related to charity care and charitable organizations, the answer here is that the applicable manufacturer may not be required to report the contributions if it fits under one of two exceptions. One, the exception for in-kind items for the provision of charity care, which we just discussed, which requires that the product be used only for patients who cannot pay. Or there's an exception for indirect payments through a third party, which applies only if the identity of the recipient is unknown to the manufacturer. Now, if the exception for charity care doesn't apply, which was the first exception that we talked about, the proposed rule has created this exception for certain indirect payments made through third parties. And what this exception does is it relieves the manufacturer of the reporting obligations only if the manufacturer is unaware of the covered recipient's identity. And what the preamble does is gives you a little bit more of a flavor of what CMS is talking about. So let's say a manufacturer provides a payment through a third party to certain department chairs at a hospital. This payment would need to be reported because even though the applicable manufacturer did not name the recipients, their identities are available and most likely known by the manufacturer. And so you would need to parse this out and figure out, you know, what it is that you know and what you can find out. I'll turn it back to you, Jim.
Great. Slide 24, how should an applicable manufacturer treat reprints of journal articles distributed to physicians for purposes of Sunshine Act reporting?
I can take this question, Jim. We've heard this question a few different times. You know, there are a couple of potential exceptions that might apply to reprints. Certainly, if the reprint is under $10, it could qualify for the what we're calling the de minimis exception, referring to the $10 rule under the statute and the proposed rule. Although, of course, the drawback of that exception is that the payment would still need to be tracked. The reprint would still need to be tracked in case that particular recipient receives more than $100 in the aggregate for the calendar year. And as I understand it, you know, there are going to be situations where this exception won't work at all because, in some cases, reprints can be very expensive. So another exclusion to consider would be the one for educational materials that we just talked about, and that's arguably a better fit, particularly given how CMS has proposed to define it and the arguable analogies between a textbook on the one hand and reprints on the other. I think there can be some good arguments made about why reprints have a similar function to textbooks, which CMS is proposing to fall into that educational materials exception. Of course, we'll have to see how the final rule defines the exception to know whether the educational materials exception would even be available for reprints.
Thanks, Mina. Danielle, going to slide 25, how should an applicable manufacturer track payments for food and beverages in the context of group meals where the manufacturer is unable to determine who participates in the meal?
Sure. Juan touched on this a bit in the intro, but in this situation where it's difficult for the manufacturer to know who is partaking in the meal or who is participating in the meal, the proposed rule instructs manufacturers to report the cost per covered recipient receiving the meal, not necessarily whether they're eating or sharing in the meal. An example from the proposed rule is when a manufacturer sales rep brings $25 of donuts to a solo practitioner's office. There, regardless of whether the nurse or the receptionist also has a donut, or even if the doctor doesn't have any at all, the imputed cost to the cover recipient would be the full $25. And as Haywan also mentioned, that would be above the minimum threshold, so it would have to be reported. Alternatively, another example is if the same donuts for $25 were taken to a physician group practice that had five physicians, the cost per cover recipient would be $5. And this payment would be below the minimum threshold, but obviously, again, something you'd want to track in case any one recipient receives payments from the manufacturer in excess of $100. CMS is seeking comments on this proposal and whether it's burdensome and whether it's equitable. In some respects, in my view, I think it might be less burdensome because instead of having a manufacturer go in and have a sign-in sheet or watch who's taking the meal, they can just know how many doctors are in that practice group or how many physicians are in a particular department. But there's also the equitable consideration about whether it's unfairly attributing certain payments to doctors who didn't even receive the meal. So just something to think about.
Thanks, Danielle. I think in the interest of time, we're going to skip slide 26. Slide 27, are applicable manufacturers required to report payments or transfers of value made on their behalf by CROs to covered recipients on behalf of the manufacturer?
Jim, this is the one I could take this one. The short answer is yes. Manufacturers must track and report payments made through CROs, assuming that the manufacturers know the identity of the covered recipients. Under the proposed rule, the payments or transfers of value made through a CRO fall into the category of research payments, and it requires the manufacturers to designate their research as direct or indirect. Now, the distinction between indirect and direct payment, as I discussed earlier, does not turn on whether a CRO is involved. Now, CMS acknowledges that sometimes the manufacturer and the CRO just may not know who the research payment is being distributed to, especially in indirect research payments. Despite this, and of course, they're accepting comments, yada, yada, but CMS wants you to report the entire amount for each research payment, either to a covered recipient or a research institution. But for a physician-covered recipient, CMS is saying that it's not going to aggregate the research payment with other payments made to that person. For teaching hospitals, CMS feels like they can aggregate the research payment with other payments to that institution.
Thanks. Research payments is a rich area here, and we got several questions on it. Slide 28, how should an applicable manufacturer report research payments made indirectly to a covered recipient through a third party, such as a private clinic or university?
Yeah, this is Mina. I can take that one. The short answer is, and Haywan just touched on this with slide 27, is that you must report the total amount paid to the clinic, hospital, or other institution conducting the research for each principal investigator, which again, leads to some potential problems of misperception, particularly among consumers who might view the transparency reports and see, a payment to a covered physician and may misunderstand that entire amount went to the covered physician when in fact that's the amount that went to the clinic, hospital, or institution. Now, of course, if the university at issue has a teaching hospital and the payment went to the teaching hospital, this would both have to be reported as a direct research payment to the teaching hospital and then an indirect payment to the covered physician.
Thanks. Slide 29, during the publication delay period, are applicable manufacturers required to report research payments that are subject to delay?
Thanks, Jim. Yes. Although the Secretary is going to delay publication of payments made for clinical investigations or product research or development agreements, manufacturers are still stuck, basically, tracking and reporting these transfers at the time they're paid. You must report on the first reporting date following the year in which they occur, and the manufacturers themselves bear the responsibility of indicating on their reports whether or not these payments or transfers of value should be granted delayed publication.
Thanks. We got a couple of questions on the report format itself. slide 30, can an applicable manufacturer report payments using the physician's state license number if the manufacturer does not have the physician's NPI?
I can take that one, Jim. So here, the proposed rule is pretty clear on this, that in addition to other identifying information about the covered physician, such as their name, address, and specialty, the manufacturer must report the physician's national provider identifier number, or NPI. CMS states in the proposed rule that the NPIs are publicly available through the National Plan and Provider Enumeration System, which is maintained on CMS's website. And there's also a link to this website in the proposed rule. There, manufacturers can look up the NPIs by the physician name, and the database can also be downloaded. CMS says that this website's frequently updated. And then also in the proposed rule, CMS proposes that for manufacturers who don't, for physicians who are not listed in this database, the onus is on the manufacturer to directly contact the physician and get their information from them. And then also CMS is considering whether to require applicable manufacturers to report other unique identifiers, such as state license numbers, for physicians who don't have an NPI.
Thanks. How about reporting payment on slide 31 to a physician consultant for services that are performed multiple times over the course of a year?
Sure. So here, Sunshine Act report requires manufacturers to report the date of each payment when they're made. But under the proposed rule, CMS acknowledges that for certain arrangements, such as consulting arrangements, they don't always occur on just one date. So there, CMS proposes to allow applicable manufacturers to use their discretion and to decide whether they're going to report the payment on the first date that it's issued as one lump sum, or whether to report them as individual line items on the report for each time the payment is made. CMS is soliciting comments on this and also seeking to get comments on whether it should require one consistent format for manufacturers to follow with this regard. I think the important thing here is for manufacturers to be consistent in their approach. There's opportunity for the perception that they're trying to game the system if they're not treating similar payments the same. For example, this could come up when a payment for a multiple date transfer value straddles two reporting periods, and some are in one reporting period and others in the other, and the manufacturer here decides to split them up in multiple payments, but in other instances had reported them all as one payment at the time. So just another consideration.
Thanks, Danielle. Slide 32, are manufacturers required to report payments made to a covered recipient through a third-party patient advocacy organization? Nina, do you want to take that one?
Sure. Well, you know, certainly a payment to a third-party patient advocacy organization itself would not be a reportable payment, but the question is whether a payment that's made through that organization to a covered physician would be reportable. And there the answer is potentially yes. This would turn on the aspect of the statute and the proposed rule that talk about whether or not the manufacturer is aware of the identity of the recipient when you're dealing with an indirect payment. And the proposed rule, as we discussed earlier, sets forth a standard of knowledge for whether or not the manufacturer is aware of the identity. And so to ensure that payments are through third parties are reported, CMS proposed that an applicable manufacturer is aware of the identity of a covered recipient if it has either actual knowledge of or acts in deliberate ignorance or reckless disregard of the identity of the covered recipient. I know some manufacturers out there are dealing with thorny questions about, you know, well, we gave the money, you know, to the organization and then they selected who the covered physicians that the money went to. Do we have to report that? And, I do think that the question turns on the standard of being aware of the identity of the physician. So that's what I would focus on when trying to analyze those types of questions.
Thanks. And our last question here on slide 33 regards an issue that I think a lot of people are thinking about given the government's actions against individual people in companies. Person who's signing this report, are they going to be subject to personal liability for any errors or omissions that are in that report?
I can take that one, Jim. I agree. I think it's a really interesting issue, especially in light of the specter of the Park Doctrine, and I think it's certainly a risk to bear in mind. It's not a risk that's unique to the Sunshine Act circumstance, but it is an issue, yet another set of responsibilities that executives at companies are going to have to think about, and that's clearly CMS's intent. They could have proposed that attestation simply rest with a designated individual, an individual designated by the one of the executives. They've certainly done that in other contexts, but here it seems that they've gone out of their way to make sure that it's either the CEO, CFO, or CCO that signs the attestation forms. So that this is going to be a risk to be aware of given the existing case law and frankly recent prosecutorial activity in the healthcare sector as it relates to executive liability.
Thanks, Mina. Well, we have a few minutes left, and we'd like to open it up to anybody who has a question that they'd like to have answered. Allie, will you come back on and tell folks how they can do that?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Carter Santos.
Hi. What if you sell a covered product today, but you're phasing it out essentially, and by the time the collection period starts, you've stopped selling and distributing it, but you continue to support it in terms of providing fixes where problems are identified or updating it for regulatory purposes. Would that still be considered manufacturing, even though you've stopped selling it?
Would you have transferred the NDA to another company?
No, you've just phased it out like a product. You phased out, no longer actively selling it, but are continuing to support existing clients who have not stopped using it yet.
I see. So continuing support, but no more manufacturing.
Well, except to address problems that the clients have identified that they need help fixing.
Okay.
I can comment on that and would welcome the other speakers to comment as well. I think at least part of that just depends on the definition of sale or distribution as those terms are being used in the definition of applicable manufacturer. So that's one area I would look at. I think it would also depend in part whether there are any other covered products that the company might be offering. But assuming there are not, if this is the only product, I think the question would be whether the support activities would somehow be construed as an activity in furtherance of distribution of the product. And I don't believe that a definition of distribution has been proposed for purposes of the Sunshine Act.
And it may be that if you're still providing support that includes, sending out a replacement, that would be considered distribution for purposes of the Act, but otherwise not. Thank you. Good question. Do we have another question?
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad to ask a question.
Jim, while we're waiting, this is Taewon. I was thinking there were some other questions that were raised that we were not able to address formally in the presentation. Did you want me to start with those if there aren't any others on the line?
Absolutely.
Okay. Someone asked whether manufacturers would be required to make reports available to covered entities for review prior to submitting them to CMS. And also wanted to know if CMS would allow the covered entities to look at the items of value that's attributed to them prior to posting on the publicly searchable database. I thought this was a very good question because CMS has some rules around this 45-day review period. Are manufacturers required to make reports available? No. It's a could, not should, or must. CMS is quite mushy, actually, in this area of the preamble about what to do because they understand that it would be quite onerous for them to constantly be updating the database. It would be difficult. They don't certainly want to arbitrate disputes between applicable manufacturers or GPOs with covered recipients, but they do want information to flow and alert people. So they have proposals where, you know, recipients may be able to log in and register with CMS to make sure they receive communication about the process for review. The regs specifically talk about a 45-day review period for the people and entities submitting the reports to review and make sure there's no data error and calculation error. They themselves reserve the right to make corrections outside of this 45-day period. So they understand that there will be mistakes inevitably with any new product or process that they're going to be promulgating and implementing, but there are some fixes.
Great, thanks. Allie, have we received any more questions?
No, I'm sorry, you do have a question from Carter Santos.
Hi, my question is, what if it costs, say, you know, you have one product, you don't really sell much of it. What if it costs more to comply than it would be just to pay the penalty? Could you just, you know, pay the penalty? And if so, you know, and not report anything? And then would there be any implications to doing that?
Any thoughts on that? I'd say in general, I'm not sure you want to put yourself in the position of completely being out of compliance. I think that would definitely put you in a situation where you are subjecting yourself to probably intense scrutiny from the various authorities, the OIG, the U.S. Attorney's offices. They do, you know, remember they do have audit authority, and they can, if they think you're not disclosing something that you're supposed to, they can go in and essentially force that disclosure. So not sure that would be the wisest course of action, even if it might appear at the beginning that it might cost less to comply than to actually pay the fine.
Jim, this is Haywan, and I think there are PR and optics considerations as well. I think when the database goes live and reports of non-compliance come out, I think the media will be having a frenzy.
Great. Allie, any other questions?
No, sir, not at this time.
Okay. Well, I think we're at the end of our allotted time here. We hope that you found this to be a useful teleconference, and hope that you were able to get at least most of the questions answered. Of course, we'd be happy to answer any of your other questions offline, but thank you very much for your time, and we look forward to talking to you again.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.